This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It wasn't until my guest Susan Barry was in college that she realized she didn't see like other people did. She didn't see in 3D. Her world was only two-dimensional. She didn't have 3D stereoscopic vision as a result of having developed severely crossed eyes when she was a baby. Once she comprehended that she was missing something important, she found a developmental optometrist who taught her how to train her eyes to see in 3D. Susan Barry's success challenged the popular theory that certain aspects of sensory development, including stereoscopic vision, had to be acquired in the first few years of life. Neurologist and writer Oliver Sacks devotes a chapter to Susan Barry in his forthcoming book. Barry has written a memoir called Fixing My Gaze, A Scientist's Journey into Seeing in Three Dimensions. It's just come out in paperback. She's a professor of neurobiology at Mount Holyoke College. Her husband is an astronaut who has dealt with sensory changes in space, as we'll hear a little later. Susan Barry, welcome to Fresh Air. Describe what you were missing when you didn't see in stereo.
When I didn't see in stereo, space was very contracted and compacted. So, for example, if I looked at a tree, the leaves or the branches would appear to overlap one in front of another, but I didn't actually see the pockets of space between the individual leaves or branches.
Kind of like a movie or a moving painting.
Yes, kind of like a movie or a moving painting or a collage. Yes, something like that.
So if you're not in 3D as you're looking, and the world seems kind of flat, there's no space between things, where are you? Are you in front of everything that you're looking at?
That actually was my impression, although I have to tell you that before my vision changed, I could not have told you that space was contracted and compacted. I didn't know any other way of seeing. And that was one of the great surprises of gaining stereo vision, was seeing the world in a whole new way that I could not even imagine.
So how do the two eyes produce stereoscopic vision, and what was wrong with your eyes that prevented you from seeing that way?
So the key to stereoscopic vision is that the two eyes have to point or be aimed at the same place in space at the same time. And when that happens, the brain can integrate the information coming from the two eyes. I was cross-eyed since the very first months of life, which meant that if I were to look at you, Terry, I would be looking at you with one eye and the other eye was turned in. And so the two eyes were not aimed at the same place in space at the same time, and the brain then could not integrate the information from the two eyes, and therefore I had no stereo vision.
So did the brain have to learn how to deal with two different pictures from two different eyes?
Exactly. Actually, you know, a person is meant to aim the two eyes at the same place in space at the same time and integrate that information. And if you don't do that, if one eye is looking one place and the other eye is looking someplace else, then you're going to suffer from two major consequences. One is double vision. And the second consequence is a phenomenon called visual confusion. And that means, for example, if I were looking at your face with my right eye, and my left eye, let's say, was turned and was aimed at the clock, then I would see your face and the clock in the same place in space, as if they were overlapping. That's visual confusion. And so it should be obvious that if you either see a single thing as double, or you see two things in the same place that are actually located in different positions in space, then you're going to have a hard time moving around and manipulating objects.
So your brain was tuning out one of your eyes.
Exactly. You know, I needed to have a single view of the world in order to move through it. And so the primary adaptation to having misaligned eyes, a condition also called strabismus, is to suppress the input from one eye. And then you don't have to worry about double vision or visual confusion.
So
of course, you don't have stereo vision, but you don't have to worry about a double view of the world.
Is it always the same eye that's being suppressed?
That depends on the person. In my case, no. I alternated rapidly. So I might look at you, for example, with my right eye and turn in the left and suppress the left eye's input. And then in the next glance, look at you with the left eye and turn in the right.
So you'd keep getting alternating views of me if you were doing that.
Exactly.
That must have been kind of confusing.
It was very confusing, although I was not aware as to why my vision seemed unstable and confusing until I went to see a developmental optometrist at the age of 48. But I would often look in the distance and everything would appear to jitter.
Wow. Now, so what caused your cross-eyedness that led to this lack of stereoscopic vision? Was it a muscular problem?
Unlikely. In fact, I have very good eye muscles. I can move them in all directions. And that is generally true for people who develop strabismus in infancy. It's generally the case that their eye muscles and the innervation of the eye muscles are fine. The problem is in the way the brain coordinates the two eyes. My guess is that if I was unable to fuse images as a baby, that means point the two eyes at the same place in space and therefore merge the input from the two eyes in my brain. If I was unable to do that, unable to fuse, then I'm going to suffer from visual confusion and double vision. And so the brain needs then to suppress one eye's input. And it's actually easier to suppress an eye's input if you turn the eye. So I might have started out with a subtle eye misalignment and had trouble fusing input from the two eyes. And so what the brain then did was turn in one eye even more, leading to a very frank strabismus, a very obvious cross-eyedness. And often parents notice with their cross-eyed children that they start out with a little misalignment and it gets worse over time. And that may be because the child is adapting to this confusing view of the world by turning in and suppressing one of the eyes even more than it was initially turned in.
Now, you had several surgeries as a child to try to correct your crossed eyes. So how many surgeries did you have and what were they doing? What were the surgeries supposed to accomplish?
So I had three surgeries, and the first one was when I was 2 years and 4 months old, and the second one was when I was 3 years and 4 months old, and the third surgery was when I was seven. And the idea behind the surgeries was to realign the eyes in their orbits. So your eyes are actually suspended in the orbit by six what are called extraocular eye muscles. And what my surgeon told my parents was you could sort of think of the eyes like being suspended in their orbits like a horse's head being held by the reins. And if you pulled one rein more, let's say if you pulled the rein on the right side more and loosened the one on the left side, then the horse's head would turn to the right. And so what the surgery was supposed to do was to realign the eyes in their orbits by taking the eye muscles, shortening some of them, reattaching them to the eye orbit, to, kind of reorient where the eye sat. Also, by doing those operations, the idea was to sort of make it harder for me to turn in my eyes and easier for me to turn out my eyes in the hopes that that would correct the tendency I had to look with one eye and turn in the other one.
So the theory has been that if you don't train your eyes to see in stereo by a certain age, it's never going to happen, that your brain can't relearn how to process imaging after a certain age. And what was that age believed to be?
So you're talking about a theory called the critical period, that there would be a critical period for the development of stereo vision, the ability to see in 3D. And some people would say, although that critical period lasts through the first year of life, or maybe the first 2 years of life, or the first 6 to 8 years of life, but certainly not past early childhood. That was the mental mindset for the past half century.
But at the age of 48, you started therapy to retrain your eyes. What convinced you, knowing what you knew about this critical period theory, that you could maybe do it anyways, that you could maybe retrain your eyes anyways?
So I actually went for vision therapy not to gain stereo vision. I am a neurobiology professor. I had taught for years in the classroom about the concept of the critical period, that stereo vision had to develop in early life, or it was not possible to gain it in adulthood. And when I went to see a developmental optometrist, what my major complaint was this jittery worldview that I had, that when I looked in the distance, everything seemed to jitter. I couldn't drive and read road signs at the same time. And in fact, even in the classroom, I wouldn't look at students in the back of the class, because to look, especially in a large classroom, to look into the distance took a great deal of effort. Even though the vision in my two eyes with my glasses was 20/20, my acuity was just fine. But because of the conflict between the two eyes, it was difficult to look in the distance. So when I went to see my developmental optometrist, a woman named Teresa Ruggiero, my major goal was to find a way to see more comfortably, to be able to drive more comfortably, to be able to read signs while driving, to be able to drive at night, to be able to play tennis or read for more than 20 minutes without feeling some eye fatigue, and so on. I did not expect that I would be able to gain stereo vision. In fact, I was quite convinced of the opposite, that stereo vision was well beyond me.
So what are some of the things she taught you that enabled you to see in 3D?
The most important thing that Dr. Ruggiero taught me was that I had to break my old habits, my old ways of seeing. And the way that I saw was to look with one eye and turn in the other. When I turned in that eye, I could suppress its input. And that gave me a single view of the world. What she taught me was how to point the two eyes at the same place in space at the same time. And when I could do that, I no longer had to suppress one eye's input, because the brain was receiving correlated information from the two eyes. And to my absolute astonishment, the result of learning that skill was that I began to see in 3D.
So you've done a series of exercises, a whole course of training to get your eyes to look in the same place at the same time, to work as a team as opposed to having each eye do something individual. This has enabled you to see in 3D. Give us an example of one exercise that's been very helpful to you.
Well, I think people now are aware of various 3D displays through 3D movies like Avatar and Up and Despicable Me. And in these 3D movies, perhaps people are aware of the fact that what's happening is that a different image is being presented to the two eyes through the 3D glasses. So I did a lot of work as well using 3D glasses and stereograms or stereo displays. And basically, the way these stereograms worked is that when I wore the 3D glasses, each eye only saw one image. So the right eye saw a different image from the left eye. And then it was up to me to fuse the two images into one. And when I did, the image I was looking at would pop off of the stereogram sheet and float in the air, either in front of the sheet or behind the sheet. And I continue to work with stereograms like that and see those stereo images floating in space, either in front or behind the sheet, depending upon the way that I'm looking. And that helps to keep reminding my brain to see in stereo.
Interesting. What is the most thrilling thing that you've seen since learning to see in 3D?
I guess I would have to say trees. Over and over again, something that I see every day because I walk to work every day and so on and so forth. The way tree canopies are, where the branches are reaching out toward you, where the different branches enclose palpable pockets of space. I sometimes find myself just admiring the pockets of space between the different branches in a tree and actually walking in and immersing myself into those pockets of space. It is just beautiful. It's just a beautiful sensation. The sense of immersion in a 3D world is very dramatic and very different from the way that I used to see. For example, in the past, when I would look at a snowfall before my vision changed, the snow would appear to fall in one flat sheet at a distance in front of me. I did not feel like I was part of the snowfall, but I was looking in on the snowfall. But after my vision changed, when I watched the snow coming down from the sky, each flake is in its own space, and there are palpable volumes of space between each snowflake. And all of the snowflakes produce this beautiful three-dimensional dance. And I feel myself immersed in the snowfall, surrounded by these snowflakes, enveloped by the snow. And this is just a wonderful experience. And so it's not like I would tell you, oh, one day I saw the Grand Canyon and that was spectacular. It's as if every day, over and over again, I get these moments of absolute joy when I look at a tree or a snowfall or the leaves coming down from a tree and so on and so forth. And I see all this in three dimensions, and it's just a very joyful experience.
But you write that sometimes your new immersion in the world can be unnerving and even frightening.
Yes, it can. And I've developed a fear of heights, which I really never had before. When I am looking, down from a window in a very tall building, I find that unnerving. Or shortly after my vision changed, we took a trip to Hawaii, me and my husband and kids. We all went to Hawaii, and we stopped at one of those scenic viewing points. And I went up to the fence at the viewing point and looked down over the fence at this spectacular canyon. And I had this sense of just how much volume I was looking into, how much space I was looking into, how deep that canyon was, how big it was. And I found it extremely nerve-wracking and backed away from the fence, put other people in front of me, other tourists who are also looking, you know, down at that beautiful canyon. And later on that day, my children and husband and I went for a hike. And every time they came close to the cliff's edge, I really had to discipline myself not to scream out at them, "Don't get so close." Because now with this greater sense of this volumes of space around me, I did develop a sort of fear of heights. I mean, it's not a pathological fear of heights, but certainly a greater sensitivity to that sense of being up high than I had before.
And do you think that's because you perceive being high up more clearly and more three-dimensionally than you did before, and therefore perceive the potential for horrific damage if you fell?
I think it is because I perceive much more volume than I did before. But I don't think the fear is because I then sort of cognitively imagine, gee, if I fell, I would kill myself, let's say. I think it's a new sense for me still of where I am in space, how I am located in space, how far away I am from that cliff's edge, and how, you know, how much space there is beyond the cliff, that I am still learning.
So once you learned to see 3D, do you think you were any more or less clumsy than you were before? Not to imply that you were ever clumsy, but everybody's a little clumsy.
Oh, I was clumsy. I was definitely clumsy. And once I learned to see in 3D, I was indeed less clumsy. I found I could do things like my kids love to play Ultimate Frisbee. And sometimes we will go out and play a Frisbee game. And I could actually jump and turn and catch the Frisbee all in one motion. That would have been impossible before I learned how to use the two eyes together.
Does driving seem any more or less risky with 3D than it did with 2D vision?
Oh, it is much easier to drive now than it used to be, especially at night when your sense of depth through stereopsis, through stereo vision, is really important. And I had a funny incident because I drive very, very slowly. In fact, I had one neighbor who told me she didn't even have the nervous system to drive behind me when we were driving down our neighborhood streets, just that it would drive her crazy because I drove so slowly. After my vision changed, driving became much smoother. I could come up to a corner, look both ways, and turn the car without sort of having to stop, assess the situation, and then move on. So driving became much smoother. And I can remember one day driving along a country road between South Hadley and Northampton, Massachusetts. And my son said to me, "Mom," and I said, "Yes." He goes, "Do you know you're going 50 miles an hour?" And I didn't normally drive 50 miles an hour, but this was after my vision had changed. I was much more relaxed. I was actually enjoying the drive down the country road, and I had no idea that I could comfortably drive at that speed. So, yes, in short, driving became easier after my vision changed.
You were told that if you didn't develop the ability to see in 3D in your childhood, that you'd never develop it because the brain basically isn't plastic enough to relearn things like that, you know, to relearn how to process vision. But you disproved that at the age of 48. But you had some inklings that the brain was more capable of relearning perception than scientists said. And one of the reasons why you thought that was because of your husband's experiences. He was an astronaut, and his perceptions changed when he was in space in a gravity-free environment. And then he had to relearn how to be back on Earth in a gravity environment. Can you talk a little bit about his perceptual changes and what implications they had for you?
So my husband, Dan, was an astronaut from the years 1992 to 2005, and he flew on the space shuttle three times during that period. And when an astronaut goes up into space and is orbiting the Earth on the space shuttle, everything is in free fall. And so what that means is that he basically appeared to float on the shuttle, and everything that was not attached with Velcro to the walls of the shuttle floated along with him. Well, when that happens, your brain experiences sensory conflict. So let me explain that. For example, if you're on Earth and you tilt your head downward, then your percept is it looks like the visual world goes up as your head goes down. And there are sensory receptors in your neck muscles that say, hey, I just flexed my neck and I just bent my head down. And there are receptors in the vestibular system in your inner ear that say, gee, I just moved my head down toward the center of the Earth. When you're up in space and you move your head downward, your visual system says the head went down. The receptors in your neck muscles say the head went down. But your inner ear is now giving you not particularly truthful information because you're in this free fall condition. You're not in the normal gravity conditions of Earth. And so you're experiencing conflict. You're experiencing the conflict between what your inner ear is saying and what your other sensory systems are saying. And so, like with me, experiencing sensory conflict between my two eyes, Dan had to find a way to cope with this. And the way he coped and the way all astronauts cope is you sort of turn off your vestibular system, or you use it a lot less. You ignore that information from your inner ear because it doesn't correlate with the information you're getting from the other sensory systems like your vision. And that is how he learned to move about in space. And then when he came back from space, he initially ignored his inner ear. So for example, if you asked him to close his eyes and stand on one foot, he couldn't do it because he was ignoring that inner ear information, which is important for us on Earth to know what is up and what is down, and it's important for our balance. He couldn't walk in a straight line with his eyes closed when he first returned from space. But he readapted to the gravity environment of space in about 3 days. But after his third flight, it only took about an hour for him to become perfectly attuned to Earth's gravity again.
Did you immediately see implications for your vision when your husband had to learn how to adapt to space and then readapt to Earth? Did that immediately make you think, oh, well, maybe I can retrain my eyes. Maybe I can retrain my perceptions.
Yes and no. I was actually at the time working at the Space Center studying adaptations to, you know, changes in gravity and so on and so forth. And I was very aware of the fact that these changes were happening to astronauts who are adults, who presumably have a nervous system that isn't supposed to be so plastic anymore. And so it did occur to me that if their brains were that much more adaptable, then perhaps there was something that could happen that could allow me to see better. But I had no idea what kind of training I would need for that to happen, for me to be able to learn how to see in 3D. And so when I ended up in 2002, first visiting with a developmental optometrist, and she started to guide me through these exercises, then I thought to myself, well, if Dan could adapt to space and could change his habits and learn to adapt to a new way of living, then perhaps the adult brain really is plastic. And with these procedures, these vision therapy procedures, perhaps I too could learn how to see in a new way.
You say something in your book that I suppose is obvious, but it wasn't obvious to me. You write, seeing isn't passive.
Not at all. And it isn't obvious to a lot of people, even people who study stereo vision. They just assume that the two eyes are pointing to the same place at the same time, and therefore what really matters is then how that input from the two eyes is getting to the brain and what the brain does with it. And they don't step back to yet a sort of more beginning point, which is that you have to move your two eyes into position so that the two eyes are aimed at the same place. When you look at a close object, you have to turn in your two eyes so that the image that you're looking at falls on the central part of the retina, called the fovea of the two eyes. When you look at a more distant object, your eyes will turn out. And those movements, they're called vergence movements, are the movements that I had to learn to make. A person with strabismus, a person with misaligned eyes, doesn't make those vergence movements. I had to learn how to make them. And once I learned how to make them, then everything else followed. So for me to learn to see in stereo was a very active process. I had to be very aware of how I used my two eyes, and the procedures gave me the feedback to know that. And then I had to learn in a very conscious way how to move my two eyes differently. And it was only after that that I could begin to see in stereo. So yes, it's all a very active process.
Since it was only after the age of 48 that you were able to see in 3D with the help of eye training exercises that you did. And when you saw in 2D, you couldn't really imagine what 3D was like. Therefore, you had no idea what other people were seeing. So does this make you think that maybe all perception really is relative, that maybe what we each think of as visual reality is relative?
Yes, I do think that what we all think of as visual reality is relative. Take, for example, somebody with red-green color blindness. That's a pretty common condition found in about 7% of men. Their perception of what red looks like may be very different from what your perception of what red looks like. So their visual reality is a little different from yours. And I think on at various levels, some subtle, some not so subtle, that is true in general for visual perception.
Do you spend a lot of time looking into people's eyes? And if so, do you think you're looking for something different than other people would be?
I do now. When I was younger and my eyes were crossed, or even after my surgeries when my eyes didn't look so cross but still looked a little odd, I didn't look into people's eyes for the obvious reason that I felt that I didn't look so normal. Now I do look into people's eyes, and yes, I'm always looking to see if their eyes are straight as a result of my experience. And I'd like to tell you one story about a student of mine who was wall-eyed. That is, she had one eye that looked straight and the other eye that turned out. And she asked me once, about a year ago, what it was like to look into somebody's eyes. And I said to her, it could be a very intense experience. And then she went through vision therapy. And one day I saw her about a year later, and I was working very hard. I was my head was down. I was reading a book, and she came up to me and said hello. And I knew who it was. Let's call her Liz. And I said, hello, Liz. But I didn't look up because I really wanted to continue to do the work I was doing. But I did say to her, how are you, Liz? And she said, binocular. And I looked up and I looked into these two straight eyes, and a chill just went down my spine. It was like an electric moment to see her looking at me and to return her gaze. It was spectacular.
So you, part of the way that you taught yourself how to see in 3D was through the use of 3D glasses. I assume you went to see Avatar?
Oh, yes.
good experience.
I loved
for
Avatar.
You? Uh-huh, right.
Oh yes, yes. Especially the scenes of the forest that sort of receded way past the screen. The seeds. Oh, I think there were seeds of a tree that sort of evoked that image of the snowfall that I was describing earlier in the program. Oh yeah, I loved Avatar.
Okay.
And all 3D movies.
Great. Sue Barry, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sue Barry is the author of the memoir Fixing My Gaze, A Scientist's Journey into Seeing in Three Dimensions. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Mac Rebenack, known as Dr. John, has been a rock and R&B ambassador for his native New Orleans since the late 1960s. Although his public profile has risen and fallen over the years, the spirit of his city is a constant presence on all his albums. Music critic Milo Miles has a review of Dr. John's new album, Tribal.
She's a rich and a poor.
Also,
if the rich one rich, will the poor have more?
Also, the Rico.
Here's a mighty big gulf. She's a heavy knots.
Also, the Neo.
How did the heads get what they got?
Also, the Neo.
So many famous folks are turning 70 this year, from Ringo Starr to Al Pacino to Nancy Pelosi. It almost seems to be the hip thing to do. But among the musicians hitting the milestone, Dr. John of New Orleans, the eternal night tripper, is alone in hitting a creative peak not heard since his youth. His new album, Tribal, along with 2008's The City That Care Forgot, present a veteran wizard who blends blues, rock, soul, pop, and his own take on New Orleans voodoo music that he calls funk. These days, he sounds wise but juicy, righteously angry but graced by wit.
Don't use your maneuver on me. Play my love so cheap. Crash my dreams every time I sleep. Don't maneuver me round on your finger. A taste of your charm.
Endless horrors wrought by Hurricane Katrina seem to have roused Dr. John out of an autumnal trance, as it did other New Orleans natives Randy Newman and Alan Toussaint. In the 1990s and early 2000s, Dr. John was thumbing through America's back pages, the songbooks of Johnny Mercer and Duke Ellington, for example, not responding to current headlines. No question, these ruminations were delightful, full of ideas, and never tossed off. But Dr. John wasn't worked up, didn't develop a head of steam. That changed with City That Care Forgot. Dr. John had never made such a protest album, filled with broke-down people, built-up profiteers, and pithy lines like, "Life is a near-death experience." One prophetic highlight was Black Gold, which could serve as the anti-anthem to the Gulf oil spill.
Oh, sure they keep on drilling way down. In a deep black hole, like some old hope that I saw last soul. Upon this top lies above.
City That Care Forgot was heavy with star turns from the likes of Eric Clapton and Terrence Blanchard. And if the guest appearances on the new Tribal are much more low-key, they are also less of a distraction. And despite caustic numbers like Big Gap and Only in America, Tribal is not as angry an album as City That Care Forgot. What's With That, for example, is a droll complaint about the oceans of fast food everywhere. Other numbers are brain teasers with philosophical points. A vocal duet with drummer Herman Ernest, Them, pokes fun at people addicted to blame.
Ow, what's the least that everything would naturally get better on their own? I was wrong.
That's the problem.
And just like that, it could change. Peter Lang's in a chain. Must pull together.
It's all of us here.
Suppose we just meet and greet. And you be you and I just be me. How could we not understand what to do? I look at you.
I just want to live in harmony and
enjoy this gift of life.
Mac Rebennack has always been a bone-deep professional, and part of that means not dropping out of the game and being ready to respond when inspiration or outrage strikes. Part of professionalism also means knowing that exposure on a hot TV show like Treme indicates it's time to give it all you got on record. And Dr. John has done that. Tribal has the grandeur and savvy of your favorite crazy uncle. People don't appreciate how tricky it is to deliver this persona in popular music. Loudon Wainwright hits it at times. Bob Dylan and John Prine stumble across it regularly. Richard Thompson should try to find it more often. However, none of them will be as funky as Dr. John.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed Dr. John's new album, Tribal. The cable TV network Showtime has specialized in the last few years in half-hour series about complicated women with major issues, starring some of TV's most gifted actresses. There is Edie Falco from The Sopranos as the star of Nurse Jackie, Toni Collette playing multiple roles in The United States of Tara, Mary Louise Parker playing a mother, widow, and drug dealer in Weeds, and, beginning tonight, Laura Linney as a wife, mother, and high school teacher who learns she has cancer in The Big C. Our TV critic David Bianculli previews that series as well as tonight's season premiere of Weeds.
Television already has one series about a character whose actions and reactions to life change completely after an unexpected diagnosis of terminal cancer. That would be AMC's Breaking Bad, starring Bryan Cranston as a meek high school science teacher who reacts to his own medical death sentence by making and selling crystal meth to provide for his wife and family after he's gone. It's a brilliant show, but it's hard to imagine a TV series with a less attractive thumbnail description. In The Big C, premiering Monday night on Showtime, Laura Linney plays Kathy Jameson, who's also a high school teacher who gets cancer. She has a teen son who's a spoiled brat, and a husband, played by Oliver Platt, who's another spoiled brat, and whom she throws out of the house as one of her first reactions to her cancer diagnosis. Heavy into denial, she doesn't tell either of them about what's happening to her. And it's not until episode 3, in fact, that she makes the first steps towards acceptance by barging in on a cancer support group. But the upfront honesty she encounters there isn't easy for her to accept. Nor is the sunny outlook, which she finds positively repellent.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting.
No, please. I'm Sheila.
Kathy.
Welcome, Kathy. We're glad you're joining us. Why don't you tell us a little about you?
Oh, well, I'm Kathy Jameson. I'm 42. I have a husband and a child, neither of whom are speaking to me. So there you go.
Kathy, do you have cancer?
Wow, really buried the lead there. Yes, yes, I do. Melanoma, stage 4.
Well, since you came alone, why don't you partner with Leon there? Just pull up a chair.
Leukemia, stage 2.
for coming, Kathy. As we say, cancer is a gift. It allows you to speak up in your life and say, hey, life, this is what I want. But before you speak up, you have to find your voice, right, Mitchell?
Right.
Laura Linney is just right in this role. She's the reason to watch, and she never disappoints. And Oliver Platt, as her husband, is really good, too. They're the core of a good show, and what's best about The Big C. Unfortunately, series creator Darlene Hunt, whose biggest writing credits include the new 90210, and executive producer Jenny Bix of Sex and the City and Men in Trees, and a cancer survivor herself, have overloaded this show with characters that just don't ring true. In fact, they don't ring at all. They just sort of clunk. The people around Kathy, outside of her husband and son, are little more than cartoons. There's her younger brother, who's homeless, her across-the-street neighbor, who's crotchety and solitary, and a sassy high school student, played by Gabourey Sidibe. While Laura Linney elevates the Big C, these other poorly conceived characters drag it down. Now compare that to Weeds, where Mary Louise Parker, as suburban pot dealer Nancy Botwin, has been raising comic hell for years now. Once again, as this season begins, she's forced to load up her family and flee. This time, because her youngest son, Shane, just killed a woman who was threatening his mother. So, once again, Weeds is about to reinvent itself. With Nancy, as she shoves her teen boys into the family car, embodying the polar opposite of a role model.
I am sorry, but now you have the handbook for what not to do. And as we drive far away from here, we can talk about the many ways in which I failed you, or we can play license plate bingo. I'll let you decide.
Move over.
Climb over me.
I'm not sitting on the hump. Move over.
I'm already buckled.
Well, unbuckle and move to the middle.
You really don't want to mess with me, you know.
Move over now!
Ow! What is it with you and the violence?
Don't play the whole I'm a killer now card. That is unacceptable.
Fine.
In the case of Weeds, everyone surrounding Nancy is a believable, entertaining, complicated character, played by a talented actor. Justin Kirk, as her brother-in-law, is amazingly funny, as always. The Big C, on the other hand, has a strong supporting cast, but the writing is weak. Watch the two shows back-to-back, as Showtime is presenting them, and the comparisons are unavoidable. And, to The Big C, unfavorable. For its first few episodes, The Big C isn't just the title, it's the show's grade.
David Bianculli is TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording from jazz singer Abby Lincoln's final album, Abby Sings Abby. She died Saturday at the age of 80. We'll feature an interview with her from our archive tomorrow. This is probably her best-known original song, Throw It Away.
I think about the life I live, a figure made of clay, and think about the things I lost, the things I gave away. And when I'm in a certain mood, I search the halls and look. One night I found these magic words in a magic book. Throw it away, throw it away. Give your life, give your love, each and every day. And keep your hand wide open, let the sun shine through, 'cause you can never lose a thing if it belongs to you. There's a hand that rocks the cradle, and a hand to help us stand, with the gentle kind of motion as it moves across the land. And the hands and clenched and open. Gifts of life and love it brings. So keep your hand wide open if you need anything. Give your love, live your life each and every day, and keep your hand wide open. Let sun shine through, 'cause you can never lose a thing if it belongs to you.